Thanks for listening to this best of the NIDS View episodes. We hope you enjoy it as we offer you one of our most popular episodes of the past year.
Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another episode of the NIDS View, the roundtable discussion podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky. And we are back. You know, we've had, I think Jim was out and I was out. And Curtis, you know, we've had some guests filling in for us. And we're all back together this week. And before we started on the topic, I just wanted to pass along some very sad news. And that is that John Harvey, who is, you know, one of the graybeards in this world of physicists, he was, you know, a senior official in DOD and DOE. He has unfortunately passed away. He was a mentor to me personally and just one of the great, you know, truly decent, good human beings. And so he will definitely be missed. So thanks to John for everything. And he loved the Nationals. So we would always talk about baseball. And for those that see the, you know, the video of this podcast, I almost always wear, you know, a baseball hat and a baseball jersey for this. So he and I both shared a love of baseball. Okay. So with that sad news, we'll talk about our topic today. And there was an article that Jim came across in the Business Insider, and essentially the argument of it was that nuclear weapons are back and they are a hot topic these days. And of course, you know, it's interesting to talk about, because I was working on some research. And if you think back to the early days of the Biden administration, the 2022 NPR, there was this plan to, you know, eliminate the hedge and cancel slick them in, and then, you know, the Russians invade, the Chinese expand, and then here in June, you had the Biden official, I'm drawing a blank on name, sorry, spoke at the Arms Control Association and explained, hey, we, the administration, are not going to be able to do the things we wanted. The situation and circumstances have changed. Pranay Vaddi, sorry. It was Pranay that was, yeah, Pranay was there.
That's his name.
It took me a second. So Pranay, sorry about that. But, you know, he gave a great speech and said, hey, circumstances have changed. And then on the 1st of August, as Vipin Narang was leaving as the acting assistant secretary of defense for space policy, which handles the nuclear portfolio, Vipin, you know, if you've read Vipin's stuff, he's been sort of a minimalist all these years, but he said, hey, we're probably going to have to expand the arsenal. So this coming from an administration that has historically been sort of a minimalist, a minimum deterrent advocates, and wanting to, you know, negotiate down. But things have changed. And of course, the Strategic Posture Commission came out with their report. We came out with our very own take on, you know, what that solution is, dynamic parity. And so there's just a lot going on and a lot of interest that wasn't there for, you know, for much of our careers when we were nuclear, when nuclear wasn't cool. And so, you know, with that, gents, I guess the big sort of idea is, what are you making of this sort of resurgence? I mean, we never want a resurgence of nuclear, because, you know, the whole problem is that that means we have really dangerous adversaries. But what are you making of this resurgence, and what does it mean, and how should we and the listeners think about it, and what's your kind of general take on it? Well, either one of you, whoever wants to jump in first.
We can both talk at the same time, Curtis, and we'll just give our audience a chance to sort it out. Go ahead, Curtis.
So this particular piece, and welcome to you all. Good to see you and to the audience. Matt Lowe's piece here, Business Insider, titled "The Nuclear Weapons Era is Making a Comeback and Experts Say We're All Not Paying Attention," unquote. That's the title of the piece, is quite descriptive. For a couple of years now, we here at NIDS have been trying to give the clarion call that we've got to pay more attention to the world that is unfolding before our very eyes, and then believe what we see in our very eyes. And the challenge here is that there's only a few folks, unfortunately, on out there, at least on the minimalist side of the aisle or on the disarmament side of the aisle, that are unwilling to sort of acknowledge. They'll say all the right words, but then they won't really acknowledge the impact of what's going on. And I think this article captures a lot of it. But just to sort of get us started here, I would say that, the new nuclear era probably kicked off here in 2014 with the invasion of Crimea and sort of the first outward use of nuclear coercion by Putin. And it sort of woke up the Pentagon for sure at that time. I was they're running around those halls at that moment, and sort of woke everybody up to believe, this nuclear world may not be as dead as we thought it might be. And I think we've been slow to come around to this, distracted by a number of issues, including the global war on terror, and a number of other challenges, and it sort of peaks, if you will, with the discovery of all of these missile fields being built in the Chinese deserts. And back in 2021, discovery, by the way, that's found by not only civilian academics and reported by them, but by disarmament advocates who, to their credit, honestly call balls and strikes with regard to this thing. I'm still bothered by the idea that we didn't hear anything from our own government about these announcements. And so we still only read about them in this sort of these publicly provided reports to Congress that we've reported on in NIDS View podcasts in the past. And no one's really having the hard conversation about what's really going on out there. Adam, and I think that this article really sort of draws some attention to it and sort of debates both sides.
Yeah, it was one thing I did like about the article was that it wasn't, all of their experts that were interviewed were, as is often the case, were from the disarmament community, whereas this one was pretty balanced. So I kind of like that. Go ahead, Jim.
Including Matt Kronick, who is one of our senior fellows, by the way. I just want to point that out. So I have a real interesting take on this. And I was the instigator behind this article. I found it and said, hey, folks, we really need to do a show on this. One, I doubt our audience would even think that we would not have a kumbaya moment about this among the three of us, because we all have seen this. In fact, it's part of why NIDS exists, to bring about awareness of the peacekeeping ability of our nuclear weapons arsenal. And the fact that we're looking right now, we're finally finding an article. This is the first one I found. Finding an article that's sort of poking at three different pieces. And I want to pull those three different pieces out. The first piece that really comes out of this article is the fact that the strategic environment has gotten to the point where we are refocusing efforts on our nuclear force as a way of deterring a war between two, if not three, countries. So the three peers are there. And so that is really important to say the nuclear weapons have been doing their job for a long period of time. And then the second piece of that is, why now? Why suddenly are we changing this direction? This is where I think we can get into a little bit of conversation, although I doubt we're going to find a lot of variation between the three of us in terms of our view. And that is, in my view, that we took our eye off the prize. We moved away in a very deliberate way, away from using our nuclear weapons as a deterrent, took our eyes off of them, and left our adversaries build a force that they think will be able to be used to coerce us. And we see that, especially with Russia right now. They coerce, they try to change our behavior using their nuclear weapons. And I say using very deliberately. They're using them in negotiations and discussions, et cetera, to be able to hamper the United States. And we see China sort of doing the same thing. And then the third piece, and we could talk about all three of these. And my third piece that came of this was an interesting part when they did bring in some of the disarmament crowd into the article, where they start throwing out these red herring issues. And I thought one of the interesting things that came out is schools, and it's a direct quote from the article, you know, schools and hospitals and high-speed rails and all the things that we'd like to have in our country, we don't have them. And one reason is because we're spending trillions on nuclear weapons. Or maybe one reason why we can even think we would have these is we're not at war right now, because those kind of things fall to the wayside when you're worrying about an existential threat to your existence as a country, as we saw at the end of World War II or in any other, you know, large conflict. And so those are the pieces that I sort of pulled out of this article I thought were key for the organizations and et cetera that are listening to us. But more so, and I'll turn it back, the floor back to you, Adam, or Curtis, whoever wants to respond. But my other piece of this is the relevance that in this article that a majority of the U.S. citizenry are still not aware. And our mission is big and valuable. And our listeners' mission is big to get out there and discuss these things with people so they are aware of why we maintain this fairly cheap, I won't say cheap because it's very well designed, this very inexpensive deterrent to these peer adversaries attacking or at least threatening us in a way that we can't respond. I'll turn it back to you.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, one of the things I did here recently was I approached, you know, I live in Kansas City, and so I approached the Mid-Continent Public Library and did a proposal to travel around to all the libraries and give a 1-hour talk. And there's like 40-something libraries in the system. And to give a 1-hour talk on, you know, what are nuclear weapons and what is deterrence and why do we have them? And I sent in slides and did everything, and they came back and said, nope, we don't want that. And it was, you know, it was just, I was going to do it as a volunteer basis, and they had zero interest. And it got me to thinking, like, why would this be of no interest when it is something that, you know, is really the existential threat that we don't want to talk about or think about? And I can only think that, you know, for the library, I looked at what, you know, what they did choose and, you know, as sort of their community discussions and things of that nature. And they were largely innocuous. And they were things that were just sort of, you know, like how to weave better and, you know, things of that nature. You know, botany for kids and things like that. And I wonder if part of the issue is that we don't, you know, it's one of those things you just don't want to think about. And so therefore, you know, you say, you know, Americans say, well, if it ever comes to it, I'm going to die anyway. So why even think about it? And because we have public opinion polling and there's widespread support. The last poll said that 81% of Americans supported modernization of the nuclear arsenal. So we have widespread support. But beyond saying, hey, yeah, just go do it, I'm not sure there's a lot of people who say, yeah, I want to learn more and I want to understand it and I want to know what the Russians have, because I think they just don't want to think about it.
Well, I don't disagree with that. Pick on you, Adam, but I think the poll was 91%, and that matters. That 10% matters. I would say, to your point, you know, a lot of folks are just not aware of these things, and they're all sort of hypnotized by this misnomer that nuclear weapons are terribly expensive, and these sorts of things. You know, I reach back here to this idea here where the article refers to the cost that it will be to taxpayers. And it says the U.S. has already estimated to spend $1.5 trillion over the next 30 years on modernizing its aging nuclear forces, which experts agree must be done. Okay, and that's so that's about $50 billion a year still, you know, assuming a $1 trillion defense budget, and we're almost there. That's about 5% of the budget. So this is small numbers. I would argue that we should be complaining about the $30 trillion spent over 30 years of real conventional war-making material that we would be building and expending in and around the world to do different things. And I wanted to
have that don't have the same deterrent effect.
Or that don't have, yeah, correct. In fact, they're provocative and may cause some of the challenges we have. And Jim, you brought up Lyle Goldstein from Brown University that he fears that money will be siphoned from pressing domestic interests. And he says, quote, schools and hospitals and high-speed rails, all things we'd like to have in our country. I wasn't aware we didn't have any schools or hospitals in our country.
Well, it's because we're funding nuclear modernization that our public schools are failing, despite being the most expensive in the world, by the way.
Exactly. And he goes on to say, we don't have them. And one reason is because we're spending trillions on nuclear weapons. Well, we're not spending trillions. We're spending a trillion on modernization. And so
over how many years?
Over 30 years. Yeah. And so I did a little deep dive on high speed rail, which he says that we need to have out here. Currently, so there was a report by the Cato Institute back in 2021 that said Secretary Buttigieg's proposal to make America a world leader in high-speed rail would add more than $4 trillion to the federal debt for the construction of new rail lines, tens of billions of dollars in annual deficit spending to subsidize those costs in exchange for a high-speed rail network that's likely to carry less than 2% of the nation's travel and no freight. I go back and I look at California's been trying to build 500 miles worth of high-speed rail. It looks like they're only going to get about 119 miles for the $80 billion it's going to end up costing. That's $670 million per mile. If the plan is to build the entire 17,000-mile network that was reported in Newsweek in July of this year, that's $11.4 trillion in high-speed rail that few people are going to use. Amtrak estimates that it would cost $500 million per mile to turn its northeast corridor into a true high-speed system. That was reported back in 21. If you did that math, that's $228 billion. By California's own estimates, they say it will cost between $700 and $874 million per year to operate that 500-mile rail system should they finally get it going. And so that would mean tickets would cost between $175 and $220 per ticket to ride that rail. And if it will take an 3 hours to take the drive on the rail, even on the high-speed rail, which is double the time it would be to fly there. The last thing I'll note is that according to the Department of Transportation, between 2000 and 2022, America has averaged over 1,600 train derailments per year. So when we talk about whether or not we should be spending money on high-speed rail versus nuclear weapons, high-speed rail will only benefit a handful of folks, figuratively, compared to a nuclear deterrence, which will benefit everyone and protect all of that infrastructure. And so I really caution these academics who try to expound on and catastrophize erroneously the cost. Notice that Dr. Goldstein doesn't discuss the $1 trillion of fraud, waste, and abuse that we experience in that same 30 years. Why don't we harvest that? He doesn't seem to be bothered by any of those things. Well, or perhaps we spend less money on conventional weapons that actually wage war versus what we would pay for nuclear weapons, which actually wage peace. So I think there's a lot of argument here, and this is the benefit of NIDS. And one thing I will say, lastly here, before I give it back to you, Adam, is perhaps the reason why we're having this renaissance, as this article mentions, is because NIDS has been successful at getting some of its message out over the last 2 years.
That's right. We take full credit for this. So I want our audience to know that this was NIDS inspired in the background. Go ahead, Adam.
Well, I was just going to add on. I was going to pile on to your argument. And if you look at, because they also mentioned healthcare and public education. So if you look at public education in America, there's an inverse relationship between spending and outcome. And so the more you spend, the lower the quality you have a tendency to get. And it's not because education gets better with money. It gets more bureaucratic with money. And you get more and more and more bureaucrats who intervene with what a teacher might be able to do if she were largely or he were largely left alone. And so we actually have the most expensive education system in the world. And yet we perform in the bottom of the OECD in major measures. So more money to education is a terrible, terrible idea.
Right.
Now let's talk about healthcare. Let's talk about, I want to get on to healthcare before you jump in, Jim. So healthcare, they have done the studies, 80% of healthcare costs are behavioral related. So if we were, the number one cause of healthcare expenses for Americans is that we're really fat. And being fat means that we drive up our health related problems. And so, why do we spend so much on healthcare? Because we create the problem and we don't solve the problem. The problem isn't you need to be, obese and therefore spend a lot more on healthcare. We just need to show a little self-control. I need to do the same. And we need to slim down and our healthcare costs will plummet. So we don't need to spend more. What we do need to do is deter the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the Iranians. That's what we actually do need to do. And that's something that we can't just change our behavior, because remember, during the Obama administration, the Biden administration, they told the Russians and the Chinese, we mean you no harm. We mean you no harm. We want peace. We want to disarm. And the Russians and the Chinese just gave us the bird and went the opposite direction. So that didn't work. That behavior didn't work. Now it's time to be the America that won the Cold War.
Yeah, Adam, I appreciate that. By the way, for our audience, I think it's the first time that we've had in our show where someone says we gave someone the bird, but that's okay. I normally don't pile on, but I'm going to pile on here because the other comment is, if climate change, for example, competes with the priority to maintain peace and deter China and Russia, it will prevent us from doing it. If we have a war, during war, think about all of the environmental issues that are promoted by war, especially between two near peer countries such as us and Russia or just us and China. Imagine what that's going to do to the environment for which climate change is supposed to be, pointed toward. And so, and climate change, by the way, is supposed to be about preserving life, which is really, we don't want the climate to change because people will die. That's the argument that's made. So many people are going to die from it. We will have death and destruction during that war. So once again, the argument sort of falls empty. So now I want to flip this over to what was said earlier by Curtis in saying this was a NIDS issue. And I did find another thing that sort of is interesting. It came out in this article that's worth discussion. And that is that there are solutions to advancing our stockpile because of this, as a reaction to this, because this is a reaction to others doing what I'm going to use the arms race word. I really don't like arms race because used typically as a pejorative, but if anyone's arms racing, we're responding to an arms race by Russia. And instantly they say, well, if we respond, that's going to be an existential threat. And let me give you a number. I'm going to try to be Curtis here. So Curtis, I'm going to take yours away from you.
Can't be me.
Right now, total warheads right now in 2020, 3750, according to the Department of Energy or the State Department, I'm sorry. But right. In 1965, 31,255. We were way far away numerically in the number of warheads that were available way back in 1965, and we are in 2020. And my point is that history can only, our future we don't know, but history can be looked at in hindsight. And how many wars did we have with Russia back then? I can count them all in no ands.
Well, we had zero.
Yeah, how many rushes did we have with China back then? I think
zero,
that was
zero. We had a few brushes, zero. But you know, well, if you don't count the Korean War, but yes.
Yeah, but they were near peer, U.S. against. The point is, we had fewer near peer wars. So as people think we're going to this existential threat,
right?
Existential, remember, it gets thrown around a lot, means that the United States is going to disappear. Existential, it's not happening. It didn't happen in the past. I don't know what tomorrow brings. Tomorrow could be a new day. But anyway, my major point of that is a solution was given, one that we've talked about in this podcast. I thought was interesting. And here's another quote from the article. Multiple warheads on one intercontinental ballistic missile known as a MIRV. But most United States citizens don't understand that we no longer MIRV our weapons as we did at one time. And building more B-21 stealth bombers, which are delivery method, which, by the way, for the bombers are a great communication using Curtis's vitamin Cs. It's a great way to communicate our ambitions by putting bombers in the sky that could or could not be carrying nuclear weapons and could or could not arrive at your doorstep. And then last, basing nuclear weapons in the Indo-Pacific region. Adam, I believe that was part of an article you wrote and part of a podcast in a recent event. All three of those items were highlighted in this article as being ways in which we could add to the number of nuclear weapons available to everyone else.
Yeah.
And preserve peace.
Go ahead, Curtis.
So I just want to jump back to this piece here, and it gives a lot of great deference to the Strategic Posture Commission and some of the things that were put out. And one of the things that was a comment here was referring to Greg Weaver, who we all know, and he's been in the business a long time, respected guy. I respect him tremendously. Here's a quote from him in here, and I'm going to assume it's correct, but you know, it's a quote in here. It's worth discussing. And it says, according to Greg, quote, "If someone launched a large scale attack on the United States, there's no question we would annihilate them in response," said Weaver, an advisor to the commission. I'm have to take a little bit of umbrage to that descriptor here. We always talk about, hey, we're looking for a little controversy in the NIDS view. I think this is a bit of a Cold War rhetoric. There's still this idea that America's current posture and current numbers and current sort of game plan with regard to nuclear deterrence is not only without fail, but it doesn't need to be changed. And my question here is how would we do this? So our adversaries are regularly practicing how to evacuate their cities. If they were to do a large-scale attack on us, we have probably no plan to do a launch on warning, which means the bulk of our nuclear deterrent will be destroyed in place. Few of our submarines are at sea at any one time, and none of our bombers are on alert. So under that scenario that Greg described, how would we impose annihilation in response? And my argument is we are not postured for that kind of threat. And that is the problem. That is the problem that the commission identified. And what Dr. Narang is saying is he's come around being part of the Biden administration and somewhat of a minimalist is beginning to say, we don't necessarily have enough. I would argue we're not postured properly in order to do those things. And as we look weak, as we look like a tempting target, we could in fact provoke or entice our adversaries into maybe making that first step. And I think this is where we have to sort of get beyond the idea that no matter what we do or don't do, we still can provide a devastating response. I'm not sure that's true anymore, especially as their numbers get bigger and ours don't. They have more weapons to cover our targets and our cities. We have fewer weapons to cover their targets because their targets are growing. And then we don't posture ourselves properly to actually utilize what few capabilities that we have. And so we have to understand and embrace this idea that, you know, we hear a lot about, we've got to do it differently than we used to. That's right. We need to stop doing it the way we've been doing it for the last 20 to 30 years. And start doing it differently. And we need to acknowledge as we said in the beginning of this podcast, that the world has changed and we are late to that reaction, whether it's arms raising or arms reacting.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Now, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but I think Jim wants to have one more quick comment before we end the show.
Oh, no, Adam, you usually pass it to me at the end. And then as soon as I'm ready to say something at the end, you don't pass it to me. So I just want to make sure. Yeah, I think you do that deliberately, Adam. And
I get your hopes up and crush them.
Yeah. So two things here at the very end. One, I think you can tell that we're very passionate about this subject because we all believe that peace is really the place we want to be. And we see that through the use of nuclear weapons and the way that we posture ourselves with them. And when I say use, I'm not talking about attacking people, but using them to keep people in check. When I say people, I should say organizations or countries, in this case, other nuclear peers. So I wore my shirt. For those in the YouTube, you'll see I wore my I Love U-235 shirt from the American Nuclear Society because there are organizations that embrace the fact that we have discovered the nucleus for many things, both energy and power. And it's really important that we get that word out. And over the last 20 to 30 years, the knowledge base in the United States has really died in that area. And this comment that early on that Adam made about John Harvey's passing, and it's such a sad thing, is we're losing some of that historical legacy. And so we ask our audience to help us in getting the word out, point people to our website, point people to our podcast, have them become knowledgeable, have discussions with them, because it's important that we have a citizenry and a leadership in our country that understands this value because it's kept us at peace for so long. And so that is what I'd like to see as the end message that came from this, quote, nuclear comeback in this article. So thank you, gentlemen, for talking with me. Adam, go ahead.
All righty. Well, if you haven't checked us out on X yet, Curtis X's every morning with some great articles and comments, and we're on LinkedIn. So if you don't follow us, follow us on LinkedIn, and don't forget to read Global Security Review. And then, of course, you've got the podcast. You can watch past HUSC events, and then you can attend future HUSC events. And then if you're really interested, you can read the Dynamic Parity Report. So there's so much.
So I think we need to add that. So, you know, NIDS just recently put out Dynamic Parity. It's our strategy. It addresses a lot of the issues in this particular article that we referred to. And you and I just did a panel last week on this that will that our listeners can find, I believe, on our website and listen to that should they be interested.
All right. So there's lots of opportunities for you to get smart, and we'll try to do our part to help you out. And of course, we want to thank you for listening to this podcast. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.